Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Christina Mariani May. We'll talk to Christina about Bonfi, Tuscany, women in wine, and more. We have a bunch of Bonfi wines in front of us to taste for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Christina Mariani May is a third-generation winemaker. Her grandparents were born in the U.S. and went back to their roots in Italy in the early 1900s. Ironically, her father and uncle headed back to Italy in the late 70s to create Castello Bonfi and Brunello di Montalcino. Bonfi is now the largest contiguous vineyard in Europe. Christina joined Bonfi in the early 90s and has been the president and CEO since 2018. Christina is one of the most prominent women in wine and oversees import, distribution, and wineries in Tuscany, I think Piedmont, the Pacific Northwest. She's very much in tune to work-life balance, family first, and that's essential to Christina's success. So welcome to the Grape Nation, Christina. I just wanted to ask you something on the intro. Were your grandparents born here, went to Italy, and came back? So I got that right.
Okay. Yes, that was my grandfather.
Yeah, I thought when he was they a little were boy. There, came here, and then. Okay, so we'll get into that. We're talking to Christina at Bonfi headquarters on Long Island in New York. Beautiful space. I'm actually behind Christina is her dad's old office, right? Which is very cool. All right, so let's get started. I know a lot about the brand. I've drank a lot of the wine. Of course, I research my shows and everything. But I think to understand Bonfi, where you came from, you need to tell us a little about family history, because that leads into the founding of Bonfi. And I'm here with you, so I want to know how you came into the business. Now, let me just give you a pointer. We could do a whole show on the history of Bonfi. There are other things I want to talk to. So don't rush it, but realize, you know, I want to get to a lot of things about what you're doing and the wineries and all that.
Sure. So first of all, Sam, thank you so much for this opportunity.
It's my pleasure to be here.
It is so wonderful to have you here. I'm going to bring us to Tuscany for a moment.
Sort of feels like it.
Yes, we're on this beautiful Gold Coast estate in Long Island, which is our home away from home. So, our family goes back to a great story. 1919, my grandfather started a wine importing company in Greenwich Village, Little Italy, New York. And he named it Bonfi after the aunt whom he loved. But as we sit here in our living room here at this great old estate, my grandfather was so fortunate because he was actually born in Connecticut, and his parents were Italian, but they were carriage makers. So they were simple folk.
Horse and carriage makers?
Yeah, horse and carriage. Okay. You're talking 1880s.
Okay.
And they wanted him to be raised outside by a family member in Italy who was quite prominent at the time. Mm. So when my grandfather, John Mariani Sr., was only 10, he was shipped back to Italy. So he was born here, but sent to Saronno, which is near Milano. And he was
That Amaretto di Saronno?
Yes,
same spelling,
Amaretto,
same place.
Amaretto, cookies, same town, right? Town right outside of Montalcino.
Okay.
I mean, Montalcino, Milan. And Saronno was actually home to a lot of prominent leaders of the Catholic, Roman Catholic Church. So my great-great aunt, his aunt, Teodolinda Banfi, became head of the household for the Archbishop of Milan,
wow,
who was from Saronno. And then the Archbishop of Milan in early 1900s was elected to become Pope Pius XI.
Wow.
So
talk about hanging around with the right people.
Talking about the carriage makers knew where their son should be raised. So she was actually, Teodolinda Banfi was the first woman, speaking about women in business or women in the history of our company, she was the first woman who was not a nun to be allowed to move within the Vatican City. And she lived in the Pope's quarters and ran his entire personal life. And when she died, Sam, she was honored to be the first woman who was not a nun to be buried within the Vatican City as well. So she really was like the adopted sister.
You got to name the company after her.
Exactly. Right? And she raised my grandfather for 10 years. So he learned all about wine, food, culture, especially of Italy. So at 20, so he's a young man, he comes back to Italy, and of course goes to New York City, to Little Italy, and starts importing products from Italy, particularly wine, and named the company Banfi after the aunt who much he loved like a mom.
So he started in the import business.
Mm-hmm.
How much of it you think was wine? Half of it?
It started out as three quarters wine, and then guess what happened right after 1919 Prohibition.
Oh, right.
So that was a shift.
Right.
So what they would sell, and we actually have bottles of this in our living room, but they would sell the Amaro or the bitters to the pharmacies as mild laxatives. And
so they were able to keep some production.
Exactly.
Under
the guise of pharmaceutical laxatives. And then, of course, products from Italy, food, you know, different goods. But that's how he survived. And then it passed on to his boys.
When was that? I mean, your dad, John, and your uncle. Is it Harry?
Yes.
You know, we set up your grandfather. When did your father and uncle get into it? Did they kind of tool around and go to college and do other jobs? Or did they come right into it?
No, my father went to Cornell University.
Okay,
he was very proud.
Yeah.
Graduated in 1954.
Okay.
And not the hotel school, just, you know, arts and science. But he had kind of known that he was the oldest son, but a middle child. He had an older sister. But he kind of knew, and he would work in the warehouses and work, you know, during the summer. And people at Cornell used to call him Cecil B. DeMille because he had a wonderful creative streak. He was very smart and very loved marketing. So he would do the brochures and all the products and do it all hand design. And he just had this great visionary mind. So he came into the business after he graduated in 54. He did have to serve in the military for a little while after graduation. He spent time in Germany in the U.S. military.
Your uncle, younger or older than him?
My uncle was younger.
And did he eventually come in?
He came into the business after university and worked with my father.
So they were together pretty quickly early on.
Yes.
Did they get along?
They did. They got along wonderfully. My dad was the one who traveled and had been bringing in, because we acted as an importer to the great first gross of Burgundy and Bordeaux and Mosel and Rhine.
You're kind of jumping a step. Let's go back.
Okay.
We see what your grandfather did. We see where he came from, you know, Aunt Banfi. Your dad, which is pretty impressive generationally, you know, went to college and went to a great university, goes into the business. How was your grandfather importing?
Yes.
Wines already? Was he importing some good stuff?
Yes,
good
stuff.
So by the time your dad and uncle got there, they had a well-oiled machine of wine.
Correct. It was a successful little business. I mean, small, but mostly French wines. more than Italian because that's what they serviced
people
in New York City.
People weren't drinking as much French wine then. And I'm not sure there were a ton of guys doing what, you know, your grandfather did. I mean, there are Deutsch and Cobra, you know, maybe those guys were around or whatever. All right, so your dad comes in and what happens? I mean, does he put his imprint on it? I mean, where to think? Because things go crazy in time.
He gets a lot of success.
So, you know, walk me through a lot of that.
So they had been importing, you know, all these great Burgundian and first growths of Bordeaux. And we still have them all in our cellar today, which is pretty incredible. But he said, you know, he was a young, ambitious man. And he was like, I couldn't get arrested a lot of times trying to sell some of these wines in New York City because he said it was just so tough. People weren't consuming wine. They were having the martinis. They were having beer. They were having spirits.
And even other wine.
Not even so much wine.
Alcoholic beverage.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
And I think he was just really frustrated. And he said, this isn't what it should be for this industry. So he actually said, well, you know, I appreciate fine wines because I grew up with them and he was an Italian family. But he said, let's try to find a wine that consumers will be able to enjoy more readily because they're just not, in the 1950s and 60s, they just weren't considering wine. So he actually teamed up with a cooperative in Italy that was making a soft style wine called Lambrusco. And it was made by a cooperative, Riuniti. And he worked with them to—
What year are we talking about?
So we're talking about 1967, okay. I think. And so he then said, hey, let's craft this style a little bit for a consuming public who likes their Coca-Cola and iced tea sweetened. And they brought it in. They learned how to pasteurize it and stabilize it. You know, it was a learning curve because these wines were not made for exporting.
No.
So they had to work really hard with the winemakers. And John said, if you can, you know, give me some of this product, I can sell it for you in America. And they said, well, you know, son, can you, you know, sell, you know, to 100,000 cases. And he goes, I'll tell you what, in year one. And he said, whoa, that's ambitious. You know, wine wasn't selling that way. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I can't give you 100,000 cases in the first year, but if you give me 3 years, I'll give you 500,000 cases. And lo and behold, he brought this in and he started clever marketing it. Really
so
clever.
So his marketing interest and prowess.
That was what got
it going. Because I remember as a kid hearing,
exactly.
You know, radio spots. I can't remember the jingle, but Riuniti
on Ice.
On Ice, no less.
Yes. Right. And Riuniti on Ice, that's nice. And
that's nice, right.
He worked with a really good team and they started just, they hit a chord and it's ended up selling more wine than any imported wine in the history of America. It boomed. It brought a whole new generation of wine consumers into wine because in the 70s and 80s, people started drinking it. So like, hey, I drink. And it was in screw cap.
That preceded Sutter White's Zinfandel.
It did.
But I mean,
but that
up
was another
there with
great
that type
success
of story.
Story of,
so was he consumed because of the volume and the work, or was he emboldened that we could do this, we're making money, let's do other stuff?
Let's what do happened? Other stuff.
Okay.
Never rest on your laurels.
Right.
He's a workaholic and a perfectionist. He's 91 years old. He's getting the WSWA award. This, you know, the Wine and Spirits
yep.
Wholesalers America
Congrats
for being the
that.
Hero of the industry. He
deserves
never rests.
It.
So after that, what they decided to do was build Castello Banfi. And what was remarkable, build Castello Banfi, was he said, okay, I have success as a wine importer. I want to become a wine producer. And so if you're American, right, from New York, Italian-American, the logical place would have been to go out to the West Coast, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a whole curiosity and questions I have. I mean, the idea was, how do they wind up in Brunello? I mean, you made the point that that's over there. Most people go here. But over there is, you know, they've been introduced to Bordeaux and France. Why Brunello?
There was nothing in Brunello. So why it was.
But who pointed them to
it? Sure. A good friend and a dear colleague of my father's name, Ezio Ravella.
So Ezio Ravella, take a moment. We're all over the place, but it'll all come together. Sure. Ezio Ravella, I want you to tell me what he did at the time and certainly the impact he had on Bonfi Company, mm-hmm. Brunello, and wine.
So what he did at the time, he was a young visionary Italian winemaker who met my father during his time of service in Italy. He was the one who pointed John to the Lambrusco Riuniti Cooperative.
So Ezio has a past where he's... So John and Ezio had been communicating.
Exactly.
And Ezio's career had continued to flourish, right?
And Ezio was a young budding enologist, and John was a young... successful marketer, wine merchant, and they paired up together. And he said, I want to do something in Italy more. My heart's there. And Ezio said, we should go to the region of Montalcino. Biondi Santi makes a Brunello here, but
they were like
land.
The first, right?
Yeah, they were the original, right. But there was like nobody there. There was probably about 10 producers. And he's like, we can buy land here, and the potential is enormous. So they went over
and
together.
Flush, hopefully, with a little cash from Riuniti,
exactly,
where they could buy some property. And I'm thinking property was reasonable then?
Reasonable, dirt cheap. They were, you know, you could practically snatch it up for nothing. There was nothing there.
What, how did, so Ezio has a relationship, points him to Brunello. They go in, they buy Brunello property. Before we get into the property and all that, was it weird being an American? Wasn't it a small market, mostly families, very insular? I mean, did you get crap for that? Or
yes.
I mean, did people try to sabotage? Because you'll tell me later your philosophy is more about sharing and all that. But at the beginning, there wasn't.
No, at the beginning, we were seen as the strangers who were coming in to change a sleepy, historic territory, and we were New Yorkers.
Small. It's not like it was this big thing and you're going to change.
Ezio was running it for us. Ezio became our managing director and winemaker. So remember, while it's American owned, it's Italian run. So he was the passion and the person on the ground.
Did people begin to realize, Bonfi's Ezio, and
yes,
it's cool.
So it was a team effort, and what Ezio did was started out as research and then sharing the research with John, with other winemakers.
I want to get into that, but before that, a couple things. The property that's there now, is that mostly what was bought then, or there were acquisitions through they bought this huge...
No, it was three acquisitions,
okay,
three parcels of acquisitions.
Through how many years?
Through about, not that long, probably about 8 years.
Okay.
So it's 7,100 acres today.
About
of contiguous
third
property.
Of that.
A third is vineyards.
Okay.
A third is forests, hunting preserve and forests, and a third is other agricultural estate like prunes, plums, wheat, olive groves. But what they did was they amassed it over 3 years because it wasn't a single property, so it had to be brought together, but there was land available. And then the 12th century castle that crowned it came right in the middle of that, came for sale, and that's what today is crowned Castello Bonfi.
That was one of the later acquisitions?
Correct. So the land came first.
So people can sort of visualize this. Tell me about the evolution of the property. We talked about three acquisitions, the castle. What was there? I mean, were there winery? Was there a winery? Was there a barrel room?
Was
anything
no
planted?
There were a few vineyards planted under the estate Poggio alla Mora, which is one of our Brunellos today.
Is it P-O-G-G-I-O? Poggio.
Mm-hmm. A-L-L-E. Mora. Like of the
and
wall.
And you have some bottlings called that, right?
Correct. And that was the historic name of the 12th century castle.
That was the winery
tabletop.
Or that?
Okay. Not a winery. They had vineyards that was from the original owners of the castle. And John was, my father was actually the first wine importer in America to bring a Brunello to the United States. That's also how he knew of Poggio alla Mora, because he went as a young man to Biondi Santi and said, can you ship some wines to New York? We have some Italian restaurateurs who would like a Brunello. And wonderful Giacomo Biondi Santi said, or Franco, sorry, he said, I just don't have enough to ship. You know, I sell here in Europe. And so my father went down the street to the 12th century castle and knocked on the door, and it was called Poggio alla Mora, and he brought some of the bottles to New York.
And he wound up buying it?
Yes, and he ended up buying that estate.
Wow.
So there was not a winery, though. He had to build the winery from
scratch.
We're talking 1978.
And there was just no Brunello, no real knowledge. Isn't that crazy? It wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago. So there was knowledge of Brunello within Italy, but outside of Italy, people really didn't understand it. They knew Chianti.
Right. But they knew it in the, what's that bottle in the
basket?
The fiasco, the wicker basket.
Exactly.
Right. You know, which was similar to the other wines we talked about. Goes back to Riuniti and all that. So that's when they start coming into prominence, where they bring the wine. Now what happens? They start building. I'm sure there's an old Yiddish term called spilkes, which means you're restless. I'm sure Ezio was restless and is like, we got to build a wine, you know. So what happens as far as that?
Well, it just, well, first of all, they were very restless because they didn't know what to plant there, because most of it was virgin soil. So they were saying, what are we going to do?
Like, but they were going outside of Sangiovese thought-wise?
Yes. Oh, yes. We experimented.
Weren't they
with
looking
Cabernet,
at whites
Merlot,
first, too? Or?
Pinot Grigio, which is one of our best, San Angelo. And the Italian DOC and government regulation said Pinot Grigio cannot be grown in Tuscany. It's never been
so
grown.
So you mentioned three varietals.
Yeah.
Merlot, Cab Sauv.
Yeah.
Were super Tuscans around then or starting?
Not really, just
so
starting.
That wasn't lurking where it was an influence. You
nope.
were just thinking independently.
We were thinking, this is virgin soil. The best wines in the world at the time were kind of considered the French wines. So let's, and in the Italian—
use those.
And not just Pinot Grigio, but Pinot Gris from Alsace.
Right.
Let's try those and see how they do in Tuscany. We even planted Pinot Noir to see how it would do. So we experimented with all these because we have the largest diversity of microclimate on one single estate in all of Italy because of our size and our 29 different types of soil.
So
we
besides microclimate, you have a diversity of soils.
Correct.
So
the most
you
diverse.
Could match.
So we, because all this research had been begun with different consortios in Italy, like the Chianti Consortio had begun experimenting with Cabernet Sauvignon. But because you had to manage it between many different estates and many different growers and coordinate the research efforts, it's a much bigger project. What happened with us is we had it all in one location. So we brought in, Ezio and my father brought in University of Milan, the University of Pisa, the University of Bordeaux, UC Davis, every leading institution in the world and enologist came to Montalcino, to Castello Banfi, to study and to work. And they saw it as a clean palette.
So that doesn't happen organically. That happens as a way of how you want to do your business and share it. You know, you're starting out, you know, people are a little taken aback by you coming in. And here you are. Whatever we're doing, here's what we're doing.
Correct.
Who was the driver of that? Was that Ezio, your dad, collectively?
Collectively. They both shared a very much a vision. I always call them two brothers separated.
And
birth.
If you had to explain why they did that, what their motive was.
Their motive really—
Motive's a negative word. Their,
no.
Why they wanted it.
Their vision.
Vision.
Truly, it stands today for a better wine world. They've always said that. They're like, if a single producer, if we in Montalcino make a better Brunello or can make a Pinot Grigio, it's not going to be enough to have not only the Italian recognition of DOC, of committee, recognize what's happening in Tuscany, but we need to have the whole community behind us so we can all rise. So the idea was, if there's enough of an energy behind it and we get others around us to start experimenting and planting it as well, we'll have more of a voice to help kind of change and influence the Italian wine laws. So what's good for Italy, the EU wine laws, and hence all consumers. So that was really the vision.
So that's not a unique concept, but it's not one that's used enough.
Unfortunately, I think it
was, you know, I wouldn't say before its time, but I mean—
It was ambitious.
It was ambitious and the right thing. Imagine if most people in most industries—
Didn't share.
Or shared, you know. Where
yeah,
things-
and I think, you know, in the tech industry, we see that, you know, how just different and exclusive it is. In the wine industry—
it's proprietary.
It's proprietary. In the wine industry, it's really not. It's based on centuries of passing down of traditions, but blending those with pioneering research.
So the research covers everything?
Yes.
Every, you know, soil, climate, winemaking,
everything.
Whatever.
So you start with the soil. So we did a project called zonation. So you break out the different soil types into different zones. And then you move to the clonal work and you work with different clones from different nurseries and you plant those. Then you work on narrowing that down, right? 650 types.
This is with the universities.
This is
and,
with all the universities.
I'm sure Ezio has a crew too. Mm-hmm.
20 different leading enologists from different universities worked on and agronomists. So remember, it starts in the soil and then it moves up to the clones, then it moves to the vinification, then it moves to the wood. We experimented with different wood. So if you think about it, it's a really concerted effort between the every step of the way, every engineer, every agronomist, and every winemaker, enologist.
It's amazing. So I think the region is, you know, much better. I mean, did your dad and Ezio observe other regions doing that, or nobody had time to look at that? I mean, do we think that was going on in Bordeaux?
I think that was going on in Napa, kind of starting.
Yeah, because when you start that early and everything.
I think they started seeing it happening in Chile. My Ezio had gone down to Chile to host a tasting. And he said to my father in 1980, he said, you have to go down there and meet the people from Country Toro. And they're doing wines and research. So it was going on. You just had to know where to look. It wasn't out in the open.
Tell me this, because I came across it. Did your dad initially stumble into Piedmont first?
Yes.
Before Brunello?
Very good.
Are you there? Did you stay there? I mean, did you? I mean, the project we're talking about, Castello Bonfi, is very ambitious. What was happening?
So Piedmont was our first foray, actually, into Italy in 19.
Was that without knowing? You know, Brunello's kind
Correct.
Of have, so you got there and then Brunello
Correct.
Popped up.
So we worked with Ezio. Ezio was Piedmontese.
Oh, he was.
He was.
Okay.
And
so.
We wanted it for the sparkling wines. And because remember, we had known Lambrusco was successful. So
oh,
up in
right.
Piedmont, we do predominantly sparkling spumante as well as agave. So we are very successful today with our Rose Regale Brichetto d'Acqui, a red sparkling. So that's where we started because that's kind of what we knew. And then we saw this opportunity come up in
so
Tuscany.
If you and I talk to our friends and you say Piedmont, they'll say three things, Barolo, Barbaresco, and truffles.
Mm.
Was Barolo and Barbaresco fledgling then or established? Because when you got to Brunello, it was fledgling.
Yes.
Because admittedly, as a region, you know, you think of Tuscany, Brunello.
Correct. I think there was more opportunity. Barolo, as you know, is a very different footprint, very small estates, much more Burgundian in that style.
Very much.
So I think what they saw is Barolo was classic, just like Brunello. Barolo was starting to get attention thanks to Angelo Gaia, Piero Antonori, the Super Tuscan, my father. They're all the same age. You know, they're all about
They are.
80s into my father's 90s. But that was that generation.
Yeah.
I think what brought them to Montalcino was the warmer Tuscan sun and the climate, as well as the opportunity to get more land because the parcels could
right.
be bigger.
The way it was set up.
Exactly.
Are you still in Pomonte?
I was just there last week.
Okay.
We are not in Barolo, unfortunately. I wish we were, but we do make a Barbera d'Asti because we're just outside of Asti.
Right.
And we have a winery in Novi Liguri, which is where we make our Gavi from the Cortese grape, and a small sparkling wine and red wine facility in Strevi, near Asti.
Sure. What's interesting is you had your exposure to Bordeaux and Burgundy, you know, as an importer, and, you know, Barolo kind of fits in those categories. And when you got there, for all the right reasons, you chose to go in another direction. Christina, we have to take a quick break so we could talk about our sponsors and underwriters. When we come back, I want to talk to you about your role, what you're doing, and I want to get into the winery and philosophy and all that other stuff. We're talking to Christina Mariani May from Bonfi. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Christina Mariani May. Christina is the president and CEO of Bonfi, and you have a little taste of where they are, what they're doing, how big they are, and we'll get into that a little more. I'm curious, we'll talk about it. You joined the family business in the 90s. What were you doing before you came to work for your dad? Did you tool around a little?
I did. Not quite as much. So I attended Georgetown University.
Okay. You got to kept the tradition of going to good colleges.
Good. And I loved it. And I actually just got off teaching a master's
class
told at Georgetown.
Me,
yeah, that's
which
where I
your
was.
Dad did, and you're carrying that torch.
Exactly. Education is key.
Yeah,
sharing information, educating new generation. So during that time, I lived in Florence for a year and fell in love again.
Did you do a semester abroad? And
exactly.
That's how you, and then you stayed?
No. Well, then I stayed over the summer, but then I had to come back to finish up my senior year.
Okay.
And I did not stay. You know, I graduated. But after that, I just knew that I wanted to be in the wine business. I fell madly in love. Before that, I had worked at different, you know, kind of restaurants. I worked on Capitol Hill for a congressman. I had worked in a different marketing office, but nothing pulled me. And then when I spent that whole time in Italy and with the winery and with the Italians, I thought, this is the life I want to choose for myself.
So how much time transpired between the end of college and when you started?
Sure. So I graduated from college, and about a year later, I came to work for the business.
Oh, wow.
So it was soon after. And I have to admit, my father wanted me right away because he was an older father, you know, age-wise. He wanted me to come in and learn underneath him, where I think today, in retrospect, I would send my kids out to work for a longer period of time for
different
somebody
circumstance.
Else. Different circumstances.
Because when Lauren told me how old your dad was, and I know how old you are, but
yeah.
there's a spread. I'm like, your dad had you when he was older.
Yes, and
so that was more critical to experience.
And in retrospect, I think it was. I got my education from watching him, and he's really unique and passionate and very driven and very hardworking, very demanding. So it was not easy, you know?
Yeah. Well, stay on that not easy part, because I want to ask you this. In the past decade, maybe a little less, a little more, women have taken on more important roles in wine, running them, winemakers. And, you know, that wasn't a given, you know, that long ago. Was being a woman in the industry, and I understand you're in a family business and your dad certainly was your protector, was being a woman in the industry in Italy is different than the U.S. as far as how they perceive women and Americans and all that. Was there ever any disadvantage to you or the company being a woman, as far as advancing your efforts or vision?
Well, when I first came in to the business, I was very insecure, and particularly—
Insecure of what?
Insecure being a
young— Inexperience is one thing.
Inexperience, but insecure being a woman in a U.S. industry that was all men in suits in the distributor side as an importer.
So that's internal.
Yes.
What about external?
Externally, I craved the credibility, and I craved experience that would really kind of only come with time. So what I did do for myself, as if I'm speaking to other women coming into the business, I went back and got a business degree, which I did not have a business degree undergraduate. So I went back to Columbia and got an MBA. And that—
Was that because what you could do and learn would be helpful, or you just needed it for show? Really? But you got some
I learned a lot. Don't get
me wrong.
Yeah. But
the reason was—
I had taken business classes at undergraduate.
Right.
So the reason was I wanted to be seen as being more credible and have more on my resume that would be— impressive, because I felt as a young woman I needed more to stand up and be recognized in a room of more senior men and in a very different
time,
lifestyle, situation in the industry where there was a lot of partying and drinking and spirits, and, you know, it wasn't my comfort zone.
No.
At all. So I did not gravitate towards that part. What it did get me to do, which I am very grateful today, is I gravitated towards the winemaking portion, because that's the art and the culture and the passion. So I ended up spending a bit more time in Italy at the winery.
Which took you away from other things.
Than I did in
the
U.S.
But was as important as
anything.
Just
as important. We run two businesses.
So stay there for a second, because— Let's talk about that. In 2018, and correct me if I'm wrong, you ascended to president and CEO.
Correct.
I guess your dad thought, Christina, you're ready.
It's time.
I think we were just talking about it. But previous to 2018, what were your responsibilities? I mean, were they firmly defined? I mean, was it winemaking, or was it a little of everything?
It was managing the team in Italy, and it was more of the marketing and PR.
Okay. Were you living in Italy or just back and forth?
Back and forth, but with young children.
I was just going to say, what year was that? How old were you, and did you have kids?
I did have kids. I had babies who are now 20, 18, and 16. So it was exhausting. It was hard.
See— Being a woman in business, being a woman in an industry that's predominantly driven by men, being a mom, being held to the same standards, there's nothing harder. And then you do it by country, you know, back and forth. Did you ever lose faith in continuing to do that, or it's not worth it, or my kids are— what happens there?
What happened? Definitely. A lot.
Right.
What happened would be spells. I think it still happens in life, right? We go through spells where we don't know what we're doing. We're uncertain. I have to say what saved me and got me through it was I'm a big runner, and I love distance running. I love the time in my head to think. And whenever I would get lost or confused or scared or just want to quit. I would go for a long run. I would run a marathon. I'm a big marathoner.
That would clear you?
It would clear me. It would get it out of my system. And it would make me nervous to do it. And then I'd have a release. And after that release, I'd say, okay, what are my alternatives? I can stay at home and raise my children, which would be wonderful. But then what? Right?
They leave. You wouldn't be satisfied.
I won't be satisfied. So I'm really so proud today, Sam, because my kids had a role model in me, especially my daughter.
Sure.
And my sons as
well,
a woman.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you gravitate towards your daughter first.
Correct, but the boys now see women as, you know, just as equal, and they're so proud. And so it was all worth it, but you just can't see that in the time when you're exhausted and your heart's breaking when you have to kiss them goodbye again.
No.
And leave on another airplane.
So you were able to tough that out, and you give a lot of credit to running, which physically and mentally
helped, saved me.
I mean, your body releases endorphins and all kinds of stuff and everything. I mean, that's pretty cool. And you're still an avid runner. You run marathons and all that.
But I think you just have to find something as an outlet, you know?
Yeah. I mean, thank God. And that's a good one because
there can be others
that
are
drink,
not as good.
Get high all the time. I mean, that's not going to help anybody. All right. So now let's talk about 2018 on. Your responsibilities are as president and CEO, which obviously is to take over for your dad. And you work side by side with him. And you had an idea of how he ran the business for years. You get in there, and I don't sense there's any disrespect to your dad or turning things upside down, but what do you want to do when you get there?
So what I want to do is really continue to grow this business for a better wine world. And what I'm saying, I know that sounds like our motivation. It is our mission. What I want to do is get more and more people from this new generation into wine. Same thing my father was doing with just the different tactics in today's day and age.
Did you have any siblings? Do you have a brother or anything?
I have a sister, but she's not in the business. I used to have cousins, but they exited the business.
Okay.
They didn't want to be in it anymore. No, so I did have other family members in the business with me up until 2018.
Okay.
They exited.
All right, you fired them all. Go ahead.
And
no,
not quite.
Go
They're
ahead.
Happy.
I know.
So yes. So the vision, you know, more and more, it's not just about wine. It's about the experience.
Okay.
Building up the experience of what Tuscany and Italy is from a hospitality standpoint is very important to me. So we have to continue to craft outstanding wines at affordable luxury, but the hotel, the
make
hospitality,
it a destination.
It already is. And we've got to make it better and bigger. In that sense.
So the question I asked you, the things you started doing when you came in, was there much of that there? I think
there was yes.
I think Tuscany's done a good job.
Oh, Tuscany says a wonderful job.
But you felt
job.
For your vision and Pomfy's that you needed to.
Correct, more. And then in the U.S. side, we premiumized our portfolio. So we took a big leap of faith before the pandemic when I came in, and we got out of the business of the Riuniti and the volume wines and refocused our business.
Importation
really
mostly?
Importation.
Wait, so Riuniti was still in the portfolio and still a decent amount of bottles?
Yes, and it was an important revenue stream for the company that was kind of still built around it. So we had to rework the model.
So were there a bunch of other brands, too, that were fairly successful? So this is you. This is Christina. I got to get my sights off of this so I can put it on other things. We'll get out of that business.
And it worked because then the pandemic came.
You're spending more time on that and not
focus.
Enough.
Focus. It's not a bigger portfolio. It's not doing more things. It's doing the things you do well better.
Okay.
That is the discipline that I try to bring to it, and it is about the people. So
let's talk finances.
Sure.
I mean, do you take, forget the number specifically.
Yeah.
Do you take a big hit initially that you calculate when you get rid of, you know, that importation, or you're excited that, okay, we could deal with that and we'll build?
We're excited. We took a deal to get out of it.
Right.
So there's
you kind of sold it off to some.
Yes.
Yeah, you got something in exchange.
Business-wise, I used it to exit some other family members who didn't want to be in the business anymore, because that's what happens with third generation.
Right.
You know, that's right. To me, that's been my greatest effort, is preserving family ownership through third generation, which
right.
is the toughest
one. I mean, that's
one.
The DNA of what
so that,
this
I kind of did a dual.
When was that shedding?
2018.
It was right away. Yep. You got in.
So as soon as I became CEO, that's what I did.
Is that something you and your dad talked about?
Something
that
course.
Was lurking in the back of your
of
mind?
Of course. But it was so a bold move, because it was a big move for our company.
Right.
It worked in our favor.
So 5 years later.
It worked.
It was the right move because of where you want to focus. All right. So let's keep moving and let's talk about what we talked about. Before, which is winemaking, farming, and all of that stuff, which I'm glad to hear from your prompt that you were very much in touch with it and very much involved. So let's talk about winemaking, farming, sustainability, okay? I'm a big sustainability guy. How do you define sustainability? And how is it applied there? Just smaller bottles and packing up cardboard doesn't check. Tell me what you're doing.
So what we're doing, many
things. By the way, smaller bottles is a big deal.
No,
I agree.
You were
doing it a long time. But
I agree. I think everything's a bit, it all adds up, right? The most important way I'll begin is to say that we don't want to over-cultivate our land. We need to protect our ratio of cultivated to uncultivated, to forest. Because one of the ways we can protect is by allowing the soil, the terroir, the earth in our territory to regenerate. So only one-third of our estate is planted, is cultivated. One-third to vines. As I said, a lot of it.
So it's a whole eco-culture.
Exactly.
Just, right.
So I think maintaining that is key. I think that it's not only, you know, in sustainable farming where you're using everything natural in the vineyards, where we put in solar paneling for energy, where we have wastewater that's all protective. We have our own reservoirs. We have 7 reservoirs on our property, so we can use our own rainwater and natural rainwater, not drain it from the rivers. But also, don't forget, sustainability is about the community. It's about the society you live in.
And employees. Too.
And our employees.
Your culture.
So,
the culture around you.
Exactly. So that's what we're most proud of. I mean, we have the Equalitas, the first winery in Italy to receive this Equalitas certification for really exceptional environmental, social, and ethical responsibility. And that's where I think it's more important to protect our workers, to share our research, to give back to the community. Today, Montalcino as a town is one of the wealthiest hilltop towns in all of Tuscany. The community has over 260 producers. It's outgrown.
It's thriving,
it's,
per
it's
se.
It's the most valuable vineyard real estate in all of Italy, that
really?
Territory. So it went from being one of the poorest when we came in, and today is the highest value. So we've brought jobs. We've brought a community to life. We've brought, a renaissance, really.
So,
and I say that in a good way, because we're all sharing in it.
But based on what we discussed, you had a hand in that.
Yes, but we're all sharing in the success.
So let me ask you a question. I hope it's not uncomfortable. When you get down to the vineyard and the soil and all that, based on how much property you have and maybe the climate and all that, do you have to apply treatments to the vineyards?
No.
I mean, in a sense, are you organic or organic practice?
We are organic practice.
Okay.
To be, as you know, Sam, certified organic in the EU is very rigorous and administratively demanding, but we are organically farming it.
Right.
That's why we say sustainable.
I mean, I have a quote here. I think it was from your dad. He had a vision of pure and natural winemaking from the beginning.
That's why we started from scratch as a winery.
So even, you know, there are stories of famous wineries in Europe that right after World War II had to treat everything for volume and all. Whatever, you know, to get, I mean, your dad obviously never believed in that. And the vineyards, you know, were never, you know, which is a nice thing for something that long.
And Sam, just to tying it back to our history, that's why we built a winery from scratch. He didn't want to inherit that tradition or mistakes from past generations of winemakers and then have to fix it.
Right.
It's harder.
So
it's almost easier to do it right from the beginning.
That's an interesting point because you're talking about a time where he had this vision, you know, of pure and clean, you know, farming and all of that. That was a long time ago. I mean, science and how you could do things have evolved. I'm sure that things have been updated and all of that, or what's old is new is good. I mean, you know, you have to keep reinvesting in the winery size and all that. I mean, do you?
Technology research. One example that you bring is we have these fermenters that we patented at Banffy that are half stainless steel, half wood. And so the cap and the base.
How does that work? Is half of it on the bottom?
So the stainless is on the bottom and the top, and the sides are all French oak.
So that gives you a mixture?
Correct.
It's just not steel fermentation and not wood. It's instead of doing it in separate, you...
So it's the new old-fashioned way.
Right.
So old-fashioned to ferment in wood was to give the softest texture to the wine, especially a Sangiovese that has harsh tannins. But it was hard to clean, hard to maintain. It could build up a lot of bacteria. So we worked with the engineers to patent a silicone gasket that expands and contracts
to do what?
With the top of the stainless steels. Because the problem was you couldn't merge the breathable wood with the inert stainless and not get a perfect seal. So the oxygen would come in. They form this silicone gasket that expands and contracts, keeps the oxygen out, keeps it inert. Hence, you can use the best of both worlds. So the new technology based on an old model.
So that's an innovation. As I asked about your farming practices, let's talk about winemaking. You know, you have a revered brand. You make a lot of bottles. You have the name recognition. Does it become formulaic? I mean, does last year's wine have to taste like this year's? Because you and I know how much a vintage, whether it's weather, frost, can affect it. So talk to me about winemaking as far as, I mean, are you doing a lot of treatments or whatever? Or
so wine, as you know, changes every year. We try to keep it as consistent as possible. When you see our single vineyards, I just got back from Rome last week and we did a vertical of our Poggio Alloro Brunello Reserva over 10 vintages. So back to 1985. And it's only produced in exceptional years, but the wine changed completely between all the different vintages. What we try to do is maintain the best expression of the vintage. Now, we are in a wonderful place in Montalcino because we have so many single vineyards on our property. We can classify, declassify, blend the different Sangiovese if it's not from a single vineyard in order to capture the best quality of that vintage. I think the challenge that exists at smaller estates, and we have smaller estates ourselves in Bulgari and Maremma, is that if you cannot declassify to a Rosso di Montalcino or an IGT Toscana and blend the wines, what happens to a territory of challenge is that they feel obligated to produce a certain amount of Brunello every year. Because if they don't, they don't have other wine or labels to put the wine in.
Right.
At Banffy, we're very fortunate. We have Super Tuscan labels. We have IGT labels. We're the largest producer of Rosso di Montalcino. So we can declassify in order to maintain our standards.
Which means the wine is what it is and you don't have to do anything to bring it up a notch.
We might produce less
if it's
a weaker vintage, but we don't have
to stop. That's where size kind of helps and matters.
Diversity matters.
That's great. I mean, so you said you're the largest Rosso producer?
Mm-hmm. By far.
That's amazing. So you make dozens of wines.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to sit here and, you know, talk about every wine. But let's, you know, categorize. I mean, Castello Bonfi is known for their Brunello. Obviously, there's a lot of Rosso, Chianti. Then tell me what else is after that. We talked about Pamonti Sparklers, which we'll, you know, we'll rehash that again. But
the whites.
Okay. And the whites are?
Pinot Grigio called San Angelo. It's the only 100% Tuscan Pinot Grigio.
Okay.
Which here in the States,
which
I love.
What does Tuscany impart in a Pinot Grigio? I'm not a big Pinot Grigio fan. It's like fizzy water with lemon juice.
Not this one. But, that's why
right.
you have to
so
taste
what
it.
Is it the soil, the climate,
warmth,
the wine
climate.
Making?
It's warmer, much warmer, less acidity in the wine. So normally Pinot Grigio comes from the north up by, you know, the Alto Adige, Venice. So you're getting higher acidity, which some of them can be beautiful. Some of them could taste like water, you know, in today's day and age. When you come down to Tuscany, because the vineyards are in the valley, it gets very warm. I mean, we're just north of Rome. So you're getting more tropical fruit and a lot more natural fruit sweetness.
So you're getting an interesting
acidity,
profile.
Really different profile, richer profile.
Do you make a decent amount of that?
Oh,
or?
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
That's a—
We're very proud of that wine.
Okay, tell me what else. Other whites?
A Vermentino.
Okay, which I love.
I love Vermentino. So our La Pategola Banfi Vermentino.
That's my summer wine, Vermentino.
Oh, it's to me, it's
and where
ideal.
Is that made in Tuscany too? Or?
That's made in Montalcino in our state. We have a few vineyards in the Maremma along the coast, but most of it's from Montalcino on our property. Let's see, what else do we make? We make a Chardonnay that is just beautiful, Fontanelle Chardonnay.
Tuscan Chardonnay.
Tuscan Chardonnay. We also make, you know, our IGT Super Tuscans with Merlot, Syrah, Cabernet.
What is that called? I forgot the
so
name.
We
it's
have
a
one
four-letter name.
Cum Laude, another Sumus, and another Excelsis, all Latin
That's
names.
That's right. Those are the Super Tuscans?
Those are the Super Tuscans.
Those are the
IGT.
Cab Merlot.
Cab Merlot, always with a touch of Sangiovese.
Right. Which most people don't put a touch of Sangiovese.
No, our Excelsis does not, but Sumus and Cum Laude do, which makes it distinguishable for having a home in Tuscany.
And then in Piemonte, we talked about how you opted to make sparklers. How many different SKUs are you making in Piemonte?
Sparkling? We make about 8 different sparkling wines. We don't bring them all to America. But they are both method champenoise, a beautiful DOC called Altalanga, which is up there in Piedmont.
Right.
And we make that with our Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Altalanga is just gorgeous. And then we do some like our Rose Regali and the Charmat method.
What is the Rose Regali? It's got a nice deep hue. What are the grapes in there?
So the red sparkling of Rosa Regali is 100% Brachetto grape from the town of Acqui Terme.
Okay.
So Brachetto d'Acqui, and it must be. It's a DOCG.
Ah.
But it's sweet.
Beautiful
color.
Because
we stopped the fermentation short.
All right. Let me ask you a speed round of questions. What wine do you think you're the most well-known for?
The Brunello.
Okay. Just the plain Brunello.
Our classic Brunello.
Yeah, I mean,
Normale.
People will wait for the Reserva or whatever. What's the best-selling wine?
In volume?
Yeah.
In volume, it's probably our Chianti Classico Reserva.
Okay, and that's the Bonfi.
The Bonfi,
okay.
Yep.
So there's Bonfi Chianti Classico, Chianti Classico Reserva.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another Chianti?
There
just straight up.
Chianti Superiore.
Is that the cheapest? Not cheapest, the least.
No, the Superiore is a lesser in price because it's not from the designated zone.
Okay. Last question in this vein is, since you've been at the helm, what's the wine you're the most proud of?
Oh.
Is it something you developed, you changed, or it's just the classic Bonfi thing that you're proud of?
I think it's probably our Brunello called Poggio alla Mora, which is a selection of the best crus of the Brunellos, the best vineyards. And it's the first result of all of our years of clonal research and maximizes all of our knowledge and our research. And we put it into our finest bottling of Brunello.
So there's a lot there to unpack.
Yeah.
There's a lot of history there because that was one of that's the estate with the castle.
Yes.
Okay. The application of science, you know, and all of that clonal science. And are you saying the best lots?
Yes.
Like where
yes.
This is great, great, and you'll do all of that. So is it fair to say that's the best Bonfi Brunello?
Yes.
Okay. So you should be proud of that.
Yes.
All right. All right, listen, we do a thing called the wine list. We don't let anybody go home, go to bed, or go back to their office without answering the wine list. And I've done upwards of 300 interviews and asked everyone these same five questions. So you got to answer them. Don't obsess on the answers. Be spontaneous. I post these answers. You know, after listening to this interview, people love to hear, you know, what you're eating and drinking and all that. All right, so the first question. What are you drinking now? What's in the fridge? What are you exploring? Did the change of seasons move you around? Could be beer. I don't know.
I'm drinking a lot of our Principessa Agave Agave.
Why?
Fresh, light, tropical fruit.
Just stylistically, that's what you want,
like,
and
it.
You love what you're making.
Yes.
Do you go outside of Bonfi ever?
Of course.
So what else do you like?
Champagne.
Okay, you and me, babe. I mean, to me, that's the most underappreciated.
Champagne.
Okay.
I do. I love, if I'm also going outside, vino verde. I kind of am into the white wines right now, being a little lighter and fresher.
So I'm a wine collector.
And if
I have a cellar. Every, you know, people say, okay, I'll bring wine. I said, no, I don't want to drink your crappy wine. I'll bring the wine. So in the past few years, instead of bringing a white and a red, I bring a champagne and a red. Because what doesn't champagne go with? And when you go out to eat a lot of the first courses are seafood, shellfish, or whatever. So it goes, and everyone's like, this is amazing, you know. So champagne is a cool thing. All right, so good answers there. Quick, decisive. I like where this is going. This is the goofiest question of the five. Your favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you think a good one is. And I assume, you know, like all of us, we don't eat it every month, every, you know. What's that ooh-ah?
For me.
You.
For me, it's sitting at the Tuscan coast.
Okay.
In the summer with my family, with the Vermentino.
And?
A beautiful, probably Corvina, like a sea bass.
Okay.
Okay. Like
Corvina, the fish is
the
like
fish
a sea bass.
It's like a sea bass.
Okay.
That comes right from the sea. They just grill it simply with the oregano and the olive oil. And they put it on. It has a lemon on the side. And you've got the patate frite, the little salty fried potatoes on the side. And I'm just enjoying the richness of the Pategola Vermentino, which is a beautiful, richer white.
I was just going to say, is it a little richer
yes.
than most?
Yes.
So it could hold up to the fish.
To the fish.
The oil from the potatoes.
That is what you asked me my personal.
No, that's the answer.
But that's, I mean, that's where I'm happy.
That's a perfect
and
answer.
And chocolate and rose regale. But that's a different. That's
okay.
a different.
So that's a good pairing?
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
The best.
Wait, is this the rose regale?
This is the rose regale
with
chocolate, raspberry, like ganache or something.
Okay. So a dessert. Cake that
yes.
has is like a
any berries,
flourless
red berry.
Chocolate cake with a reduced raspberry sauce.
Yes.
This is killer.
This is it because
okay.
it has high acidity. Cuts right through it.
All right. Now, I don't know how much you get out. I know you have kids. I know you're busier than hell. And I know you're in Italy and somewhat sequestered in Long Island, but try to answer this question. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And when you answer that anywhere, when you answer this, you're not being exclusive. Like you're going to bump into a friend and they go, how come you didn't mention me? It's not about who's the best. Here's the setup. It could be a bar. It could be a restaurant. Who has a great wine program? Who has a knowledge of it? Who has the vibe?
Okay, I'm going to say this just because it was the most recent, but I'm going to say La Pergola restaurant in Rome.
Okay.
It's a 3-star Michelin.
So it's a fancy place.
It's fancy. Their wine list, you can only imagine.
Lives up to the hype of being a 3-star?
Yes, in every sense.
Okay.
So from all the different regions, I would say that. And then on top of it, the view is up on the hillside of Rome. Overlooks the entire
Is it a
city of Rome.
Freestanding restaurant?
No,
or
it's part of a hotel?
A hotel,
the Waldorf Astoria.
Okay,
hotel
and the restaurant's the View.
The restaurant
and it
is
ain't
on
a
the
hotel
terrace.
Restaurant.
No,
it's a great.
It's a separate 3-star. Okay. The View there with a wine list where you just say to the sommelier, "Bring me something unique, something new."
Leave it to them.
Leave it to them.
All right. Before we exit this question, can you give me something in Long Island or New York?
Ah, that would be your next question. Absolutely.
And the context is these are wine places.
No.
You know, you heard who Christina is. Here's places she thinks are good wine places.
Absolutely.
If they exist.
Well, of course they exist.
Okay, then give me one that you're comfortable
with. I'll do one in Long Island just because I haven't been in the city in a little while, only because I'm traveling all the time. I spend more time abroad than here. I really like a beautiful wine list, Hendrick's Tavern, which is fun.
I never heard of it. Roslyn?
Great wine list.
So North Shore, we're on the North Shore.
Old, like, tavern.
That's
great.
A first. I'm glad to present that one.
It's a really nice to present it. Also, Brass Rail in Locust Valley is a nice one.
Another good one?
Very classic. Yeah, really
so
good.
So Hendrick's Tavern has a lot of posters of Jimi Hendrix?
It's more like a British pub.
No, I know.
So I have to say, there's so many now. I mean, the one thing I look for wine lists, just let's have some diversity on
That's
it.
All. Like
you know,
curated diversity.
Interesting. From every region.
I'm with you on that.
You those, know, those will, don't bore me with just
those.
Italy,
and you
France,
know how to be bored.
California.
All right, those are all great answers. And like I said, I'll post them. Fourth question, penultimate. Favorite all-time wine? I used to ask that. What's the most expensive, well-known wine Christina ever drank? It's not that anymore. Mm. What's the wine that had the most influence that was awakening to you?
Mm.
Important.
Sumas. And it is one of ours. And I'll say it because...
So there had to be a time or a reason you drank it and it meant something.
It did. it was a new... At the time, it was a new IGT Toscana. It's Sangiovese Cabernet Syrah. It is absolutely stunning. And it was when
Always
those three grapes in different
percentages.
What's
the predominant blend usually?
Predominantly like about 40% Sangiovese, 40 Cab, 20 Syrah. Syrah is beautiful.
Okay.
I was just kind of really establishing myself in my career, and we went out on tour. I did around the world almost presenting this wine. So it became very close to me.
When was this?
This was in 1996 vintage. So it was 1999.
Okay.
About. I just graduated from Columbia
Business
School.
So that's an important wine to you.
Yes.
That.
And it was my wedding year. I graduated from business school, and I went all around to present this wine, which really was the first super Tuscan wine we could produce from our vineyards that wasn't just Sangiovese.
Right.
So it was the Cabernet
Syrah
and the
too.
Syrah, which is beautiful from Tuscany.
So that
so
wasn't hard
to
answer.
No.
No. So that's what the question is. All right, last question. The question is best wine around $15, $20, $22. I want you to recommend a red and a white. I'm going to make it easy for you.
Okay.
Bonfi is big enough and diverse that we could live in that universe and answer it with that. First, not to embarrass you, do we have wines in that price
point? Yes. All right. Very important.
So what are...
Chentenay. Chentenay for every day. Chentenay.
C-E-N-T-I-N-E. Oh, Chentenay.
So it looks like centine.
Right. I thought it was Chendani.
Yeah.
Chentenay is what?
Is red, white, and rosé, but the red is a cuvée of Sangiovese, Merlot, and Cab. It's about $12 a bottle. It is constantly rated in every wine spectator.
So it's a mini Super Tuscan blend.
As a mini Super Tuscan, it gets the best value from Tuscany every year from Wine Spectator. It is delicious.
So it's a great value wine,
delicious.
Great quality.
It has a screw cap. It's a great value. It's all the great wines from Montalcino. It's fantastic.
You know what I didn't ask you early on when we talked about the vineyard, 7,000 acres, 2,000 planted. What are the age of some of the vines out there?
Oh, up to about 50 years.
I mean, you have to replant stuff.
Yes.
You plant, but there are...
The lifespan's on average about 30 years.
Okay.
Some go back to 50, which is our single vineyard Podra Loro. Otherwise, we replant from ESCA, the wood disease. That's what seems
That's what you're up against?
Yes.
Not phylloxera or any
nope.
of that other stuff? All right, so you answered the red, mm-hmm. great value wine in white.
I'm going to say the same wine. It has a
Centine white? Centine white?
Yes, it's a Pinot Grigio.
100%?
Yes, 100% Tuscan Pinot Grigio for about $12.
Oh, my friends always ask me.
Oh, so good.
You know, they're like, I'm embarrassed to tell you I love Pinot Grigio. You know wine. What should I drink? I'm like, don't drink that, but I'll tell them
to
drink.
But it has flavor
I'll
and character.
Tell them to drink
it's
Centine.
Not watery. It's not thin.
I will tell them to drink
yes.
the Centine. All right, you did an incredible job on that. All great answers. I will post them. We're going to wrap up, but before we wrap up, we do a feature called the Weekly Wine Sip. All right. Every week we taste a different wine with a winemaker, and you brought out three wines, but we can only get to one. So I think we should try the Bonfi, the Wheelhouse, Brunello di Montalcino. We talked about the Regali a little, and even we'll talk about the Vermentino. All right, so tell me a little about this Brunello. It's the one that has come to the market, right?
Correct. This is the 2017 Banfi Brunello. Really just an outstanding vintage.
Wait, was 17 a good vintage?
It was good. It was good. 16, 15 and 16
were
awesome. Top. 17 was very good.
What's
very
the good. Tough one? 18 or was it 17?
18.
Okay. So then you're happy with the vintage year.
So we're happy
year.
With
18,
this
18. We'll talk about that another
next
time.
Next year, and it was a little tough.
All right. So happy with the vintage. Any discussion of the vintage? Warm, hot, rainy, perfect?
Warm. Warm. Very
Is that
warm
good?
Throughout. That can be good, but we have reservoirs of water, so we can irrigate our vineyards, which is good. What I pick up kind of on this is...
Let's do nose. Well, let's do sight first.
Okay.
So it's kind of a... It's kind of a deep, you know, reddish. It's not this dark, brooding wine. It's, you know, kind of a classic Brunello. Some of them are, you know, a little deeper. So that's the color. Beautiful color. On the nose, I suck at descriptors. You tell me what you get on the nose.
I mean, I'm getting deeper berry fruit, like woodsy, cassis, dark cherry.
I'm getting reds and dark.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of cedar and you know, definitely a little bit of that woodsiness is coming through with the vanillin.
Yes, I get that on the aftertaste. All right, mm-hmm. Mouthfeel is like a medium, medium plus. It is not this heavy, clawing wine at all. It's not thin.
It's got energy.
Yeah, it's got a lot of energy in the mouth.
Which is what I love about, you know, there's acidity, there's tannins, there's verb. It's like lively. It dances on your palate.
It does.
Sangiovese.
So let's talk about the palate. Does the palate descriptors mirror the nose descriptors? What do you get on the palate?
I get a lot more vibrant. Fresh fruit on the palate.
It's very fresh. The fruit is very
This wine
fresh
is young still.
Yeah.
So this is just like the new release of 2017. I'm getting a lot of vibrant tannins. Salinity a bit coming through.
I like the salinity.
And
it's
I do
not
too.
Overpowering, it's, but it's present.
But it's there. It's making your mouth water.
Yeah.
You can feel it. And that's kind of, you know, what's typical of our Sangiovese in the area. So I'm getting that salinity. Some nice wood, gentle wood, but it's fresh. The wood is there.
Yeah, it's the wood is not
but
prominent
it's not,
where it's...
It's and I'm getting a great length, but what I'm getting is a lot of energy in this glass. Like, it definitely would require food, I think. Because,
all right, so we're going to get to that.
Okay.
So here, I'm curious about wine and food pairing for this wine.
Yeah.
But so have you made wines where you go, oi, can't drink this right now. Definitely
sure.
needs time.
Sure, who doesn't?
Is right. I mean, it's not a bad
<honest.
laughs> thing. Is this a wine that's readily drinkable, do you think? I know it will benefit from age. Is this would you advise people to put
I would
it down?
Advise people to open it up and let it rest with the cork open if you're having it for dinner. Open
okay.
it a few hours.
But I'm
before.
Going backwards. Should they lay it down for 2 years?
Yes.
Or
ideally you can lay it down.
If you're patient, it'll drink even better.
If you're patient with Brunellos.
But it's drinkable now.
And a lot of Barolos, Brunellos, they always get better with age.
I think Brunello drinkers know that.
They always get better with
time
age.
And they're highly ageable.
Yeah, but they're also drinkable now, but I would open it before, earlier.
You would decant it.
And decant it.
Get
or
some
at least
oxygen
open,
in
get
it.
Some oxygen in it to open up. Because they come alive in the glass just after a little time.
All right. Now let's get to the wine and food pairing. Forget your wine and food pairing. What's the perfect wine food and pairing for Brunello and what with this?
There's a few. Bistecca Fiorentina.
Okay.
Simple.
Which always has to be rare, right?
Rare steak, lots of salt.
Okay.
So the salt, the meat, the proteins. This
I'm loving
proteins.
That.
I'm loving a beautiful ragu with a pasta. Maybe it would be in Tuscany. We do have the cinghiale.
A meat ragu.
Okay. Which is, you know, stewed.
Yeah, yeah, it's meat. It's a thick sauce.
Exactly. Those.
You pair to the sauce, not to the pasta.
You pair to the sauce. So that heavier stewed sauce, I would definitely. And then, of course, very typical. I'm not a big eater of lamb, but lamb, which is
would go well.
Would go
a
really well.
A gamier meat. You're with me, kid. I am not a big lamb guy.
Yep, I'm not.
But
big,
I get
so
the gaminess and how this could cut into.
Yeah, so that's why the bolognese is a little more my style.
Yeah,
ragu al carne.
Those are all good ones. So that's the 2017 Castello Bonfi Brunello di Montalcino. That's kind of their wheelhouse. We talked about the what's it called?
Rose Regali.
And we're not going to open it, but the La Pettegola Vermentino.
Yes.
That's the Vermentino you make in Tuscany that has a little more richness than people perceive in or people taste in.
I love Vermentinos. They're a little richer. Yep.
Yeah, I've never had
you
that.
You take this bottle home.
I have to try them. All right, listen, we got to wrap up. We've spent a lot of time blabbering about all things Bonfi, which I enjoyed very much. Let me do a quick wrap up, and then I want to get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts. Why do we ask you to subscribe? Because as soon as the episode is released, you get it. You wake up and there's Christina right next to you. Can you beat that? Follow us. Leave a review if you like the show. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. But you can always get to us through the hashtag TheGrapeNation. We're on Facebook at TheGrapeNation. As I mentioned, I will post Christina's wine list, all her good recos, and I will, in our weekly wine sip, give you the information on the Brunello and mention the other two wines, you know, which we talked about. So we'll give people information on that. So, Christina, if we want to find out more about Bonfi, what's the best way?
Bonfi, B-A-N-F-I, wines.com.
Okay. And the website has, it'll have the Rosé Regali, the Vermentino. Right.
Yes.
I mean, I've been on the site a million times.
You know,
that's
Instagram,
a good entree. Right.
I mean, really.
Let's talk social media.
Okay.
A lot of people use Instagram probably more than anything.
That may be beyond my abilities.
Oops. I don't know how that happened. Instagram handle?
Bamfi.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, not .com. At Bonfi.
Oh, at Bonfi.
Yeah.
At Bonfi. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. So, I don't want to back you against the wall here. Do you have a personal account that you care about or?
Not so much. I use the Bonfi account.
So stay with Bonfi.
I got to say.
All right. So the website and Instagram certainly are the places to go, you know, when you want information. Just one last message, Christina. Final note from my friends at La Paulet, announcing La Paulet's return to New York City. There are tickets still available for the off-the-grid tasting on February 24th, shining a light on discovery wines from the region. The Verticals tasting on March 3rd, a great way to discover the ageability of Great Burgundy, with each participating domain pouring one appellation over three vintages. And, of course, they're famous for the Grand Tasting and the Gala Dinner. featuring over 30 Burgundy domains pouring their 2020 vintage. And at the gala, some older vintages and rare formats. So go to lapaulie.com for more information. That's that whole Burgundy thing. All right, I want to thank our guest, Christina Mariani May, our engineer Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.